you to go through for in Gautama Kova. So Margaret and I had five daughters. That was an active researcher, and that, you know, there was no conflict. The family was proud of her achievements. And the same can be said of Maria Skłodowska-Curie, well known as a pioneer researcher in nuclear chemistry and physics, the winner of two Nobel Prizes. Marie Curie depended on her extended family to help with her daughters. The nuclear family spent all their free time cycling, hiking, and doing various cultural activities in Paris. And the interest of science was so pervading in her family life that daughter Irene, the elder daughter, followed in her mother's footsteps and became a well-known physicist and the winner of the Nobel Prize herself. Now, Marie Curie's life is well documented. Her daughter wrote a biography. Robert Lee, the British science journalist, wrote a biography. But there's still a new feminist assessment that we need on her life and career. In spite of the fact that there isn't a feminist biography, there is no evidence that there was any major conflict between her science and her family. In fact, hers was a family where, similarly to the previously mentioned British botanical families, science and family life were interwoven. But while nuclear physics could not be done at home, like botany could be in the 19th century in the breakfast room, the family did work together in the Curie's laboratory. Now, Kovalevskaya and Curie were among those late 19th century professional women scientists who managed to combine motherhood and science. They both lived in Europe. I should say, Curie, late 19th, early 20th century. They both lived in Europe, and this fact may be significant. Upper and middle class European women were used to leaving the physical work of homemaking to servants or family members and pursue at least some of the time their own interests. In North America, in contrast, the cult of domesticity and the notion of republican motherhood was widespread in the late 19th century. During this period, some women participated in science as non-professionals, but an increasing number of them wanted to pursue higher education and a profession in science, including medicine. But with the prevailing ideology supporting the doctrine of separate spheres, there were women who felt that they had to make a choice between a scientific career and marriage and motherhood. This undoubtedly caused conflict for some women, particularly because the New England women's colleges, which employed the largest number of women scientists, would not hire married women, while others simply had to resign after marriage. There were women who gladly embraced the opportunity to become independent and had no intentions of marrying. Many professional women believed, I quote, to be a wife meant that one had to be subordinate and that this inevitably contaminated professional aspirations and achievements. At the same time, there were women physicians, for instance, who denied that motherhood necessarily conflicted with general practice in medicine. This was a radical departure from 19th century thinking. Dr. Mary Putnam Jacobi considered that marriage complicated professional life. She nevertheless felt that, quote, the increased vigor and vitality accruing to healthy women from bearing and possession of children, a good deal more than compensates for the difficulties involved in caring for them, when professional duties replace the more usual ones of sewing, cooking, etc. And indeed, many physicians married and continued with their careers. Only few were forced to give up their practice. An excellent book on women and medicine in America called Sympathy and Science, Regina Moran Sanchez writes that, quote, available data suggests that marriage rate for women physicians was disproportionately high in the 19th and 20th centuries. Between one-fifth and one-third of American women physicians married in the 19th century, and by 1900, the marriage rate was four times the rate of professional women. Those who did not marry often adopted children. And this was true of many of the women scientists in the New England women's colleges, where the women lived in residence or faculty housing, had all the cooking and other household things done for them by servants. And so they could devote their time to science. And some of them, well, many of them, the number is not well documented yet, but many of them formed lifelong relationships with other women. This may have been lesbian relationships, they may have been just emotional or even sort of master-apprentice-type relationships. But the interesting thing is that a goodly number of these women adopted children, but not just one child, several children. And I find it intriguing that while they thought that marriage could lead to a subordinate position, they obviously didn't think that motherhood did. By 1920, there is evidence that an increasing number of North American women combined marriage, motherhood, and a career. Many became what we now term super achievers, and they needed it too. Others who could not find paid positions also combined motherhood and science, and these were the volunteer scientists who worked either on their own because they had some private income and so they could afford to devote their time to science, or who couldn't get positions for a variety of reasons, anti-nepotism regulations in small universities where the husband worked, or the simply wanting a job for women, or as married women, they couldn't find positions. So they worked as volunteer scientists, had access to science through their husband's position or through their husband's research grants or husband's laboratories. So worked as editors, journals like Helen Hughes did for other issues, stuff like that. In any case, a good example of this is the Canadian, British-born Canadian woman marine biologist Edith Bartlett. She was educated at University College London, which was, I think, the first university in England that admitted women and granted them higher degrees, and then went to live with her husband in India, where she couldn't use her background in zoology, but she worked as a medical factotum in Bihar province for the employees of the big company that her husband, the medical chemist, worked for. Then they came to Canada, and she got a job in 1917 at the University of British Columbia as demonstrator in zoology. Was paid $30 a month. Her husband, at the same time, got a position in the biochemistry department and got paid $100 a month. However, a year and a half after, they both gave up the teaching position and moved to Nanaimo, where the Canadian